In January 1840, the chill and the dampness of the London Foundation took a toll on Catherine Macaulay. Although her letters are silent about her health, Mary Teresa White, her traveling companion, notes that while they were in Bermondsey, and I quote, "Our dear mother had a miserable time of it, being almost constantly ailing. I always thought," she said, "the Bermondsey Foundation was the beginning of her death sickness, for she was never perfectly well after. While she was very ill and confined to bed in London, one morning I prepared her breakfast and brought it to her. But because I brought the best I could get, white sugar, china teapot, and cream ewer, she said, 'My heart, why did you not bring me a little tea in a mug as you would to a poor person?' Scarcely had she spoken when the tray upset and everything was spilled on her bed. Then she said pleasantly, 'Now you are punished for not remembering that your old mother is only a poor nun.'" Catherine left Dublin on Monday, January 13, 1840, arriving in Dublin the next day. For much of January, she was confined to bed with an inflammation in her stomach and her old mouth complaint, probably scurvy. Yet the first months of 1840 were filled with personal heartaches and business obligations that far overshadowed her recuperation. Her nephew, Robert Macaulay, toward whose lifestyle she had shown some displeasure, died suddenly of consumption like his two sisters on January 4th while she was still in Bermondsey. And without receiving her letter of forgiveness in response to his request. Then severe illness, including typhus, began to afflict sisters at Bagot Street, Carlow, Tullamore, Cork, Charleville, and Limerick, resulting in three deaths in 1 month, March 1840, including that of Mary Teresa Vincent Potter from typhus in Limerick. Mary Teresa was a young sister with whom Catherine had exchanged many poem letters. It was a season of sorrows, and Catherine wrote plainly, "My heart is sore." Simultaneously, business matters needed attention. Construction of the commercial laundry at Bagot Street proved to be a near disaster, the builder having put in no laundry equipment. And the architect calling Catherine's letters about the contract graciously offensive. I suppose if you're going to be offensive, it's wise to be graciously offensive. Plans for a future foundation in Birmingham, England got underway through correspondence with Dr. Thomas Walsh, Vicar Apostolic of the Midland District. Income became an issue when the charity sermon failed, the preacher falling ill on the spot before he had said a word about the House of Mercy. Archbishop Murray asked her to reopen the convent and poor school in Kingston after Easter, and preparations were needed for the promised foundation in Galway. On February 27th, 1840, five women professed their vows at Bagot Street, and two received the habit. Any thoughts Catherine had about retiring from business, as she said, were now groundless. She would leave for Galway in early May, hoping to return by way of Limerick, where, as she said, "I will greatly feel the loss that will be visible on entering the convent, the absence of her sweet little poet, Mary Teresa Vincent Potter, with whom she had exchanged poems." Catherine spent May and June in Galway. The joyous beginning of that new foundation reflected in her poem to Mary Ann Beckett, the poem that you have in her own handwriting and the poem that is here in the Melbourne archives. In that poem, she talks about creating a little foolish party with the postulants at Baggot Street. Her humor was also reflected in the poem she sent back to Baggot Street. But all of this was soon clouded by the sudden illness and death from typhus fever of the postulant, Mary Burke, one of the first women to enter the Galway community. With Teresa White, the new superior in Galway, Catherine sat beside Mary when she died at 3 a.m. on June 11th, the very day she would have received the habit of the Sisters of Mercy. Catherine remained in Galway for 3 more weeks, meeting prospective postulants, negotiating with Peter Daly, the priest who had arranged their coming to Galway. But her thoughts were often with Baggot Street, where 5 postulants for Birmingham had arrived, 4 of them before she left Dublin, where Mary Aloysius Scott was severely ill of what Dr. Dominic Corrigan called rapid decline, and where Mary de Pazzi Delaney was doing her best to manage, but also sending alarming reports to Galway. Finally, at the end of June, Father Redmond O'Hanlon sent word that Catherine was to return to Dublin immediately, thus foreclosing any possibility of her visiting her confidant, Mary Elizabeth Moore, and the sisters in Limerick on her way home. Catherine deeply felt the loss of this longed-for reunion. She wrote, "I could not recollect any circumstance that inflicted such painful disappointment on me as not going to Limerick on my return. I desired it too ardently." Back at Baggot Street on July 6th, she found that Mary Aloysius Scott, now in Booterstown, was not so ill as had been reported, though very thin and pale. But the English sisters filled the house with joy and youthful generosity. After a 6th young woman from England joined them, Catherine marveled at their willingness to consecrate themselves to the service of the poor for Christ's sake. She said, "This is some of the fire he cast on the earth kindling." By the end of July, she was arranging a reception ceremony for August 10th, treating with homemade remedies the cough she had developed in Galway, and trying to be optimistic that the commercial laundry now in operation would soon pay for itself. She assured Frances Ward, "These things take time. The expense of coal is very great, sometimes a ton a week. The fire will not cost more when the work is much increased. We have not lost anything of consequence, and only a few borders of fashionable nightcaps torn." A On July 20th in Rome, far from the practical realities of tons of coal, the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith unanimously voted to forward its Italian translation of the rule and constitutions of the Sisters of Mercy to Gregory XVI for final confirmation. Catherine soon heard unofficial reports of this positive outcome. But in late July, her mind focused on news that the construction of the Birmingham Convent was progressing rapidly. She was overwhelmed with gratitude. May God bless the poor Sisters of Mercy and make them very humble, that they may not be unworthy of the distinguished blessings God has bestowed upon them. In August 1840, Catherine gave her energies to matters at Bagot Street, planning the August 10th reception ceremony for 6 postulants, 5 of them preparing for the foundation in Birmingham to be launched a year later, arranging for Mary Aloysius Scott to go to the Good Air in Carlow, teaching the young women in the House of Mercy how to do commercial laundry without ruining their customers' clothing, responding hopefully but indefinitely to Bishop Thomas Walsh's request for a future foundation in Nottingham, England, welcoming a 7th woman as part of the future foundation in Birmingham, and engaging in a competitive concert of sighing and moaning with Mary DePazzi Delaney to jostle her assistant out of a slump. Catherine refers to this twice in 2 letters written on the same day. Evidently, DePazzi was given to sighing, frequent sighing. And Catherine says she made up her mind she was not going to be outdone. And so every time DePazzi sighed, she would moan. And that went on for a while until finally they both burst out laughing. But Catherine was tired. The 77-year-old Reverend Andrew Fitzgerald knew this. In the most tender of the surviving letters she received, he pleaded with her to come to Carlo for a visit or for the August retreat. Come to the quiet and calm residence of your dear children here. A few days with us would renovate both body and mind and send you home refreshed for new toils and labors. Have compassion on yourself and on. Plans had to be made for a profession and reception ceremony at Bagot Street in September, and then for Catherine's own immediate departure for the reception ceremony in Galway. Throughout August, Catherine entertained the hope that she could go to Limerick on the way to the reception ceremony in Galway on October 1st. But this plan, too, was dashed by the date set for the Bagot Street ceremony, September 24th, and the consequent need to go straight to Galway. Finally, in early October, she was able to visit Galway on her way back, she was able to visit Limerick on her way back from Galway. It would be her last visit with that Mercy community, and her first since the death of Mary Teresa Vincent Potter in March. By mid-October, Catherine had traveled more than 100 miles across the country 4 times in 5 months. She also hoped to visit Carlo on her return to Dublin, but an unexpected demand intervened. Dr. Thomas Griffiths, the Vicar Apostolic of London, requested, wisely as it turned out, that the Begut Street community loaned two professed sisters to Bermondsey. One of these was to be married to Sales White, Catherine's traveling companion, to Galway and Limerick. But while they were in Limerick, Reverend Peter Butler of Bermondsey, London, arrived in Dublin to escort the two sisters to England. So once again, Catherine had to rush back to Dublin on October 10th or 11th to put Mary de Sales White and Mary Xavier O'Connell on the boat to Kingston, boat to England at Kingston. On October 13th, she wrote, "Thank God I am at rest again. And now I think the name of another foundation would make me sick. But they say I would get up again." It's a wonderful expression, get up again. It's okay to go down, but get up again. Although unofficial word had been circulating in Ireland since early August that the Congregation for the Propagation of the Faith had forwarded the rule and constitutions to Gregory XVI for papal confirmation, Catherine heard nothing directly. So on October 14th, she wrote to Cardinal Franzoni, prefect of Propaganda Fide, soliciting the valuable aid which your eminence can afford. She did not hear until September 1841. The year 1840, the last full year of Catherine's life, ended with new foundations of the Sisters of Mercy in Wexford and in Birr on December 27th, and with plans underway for foundations in Birmingham and Newfoundland. The final months of 1840 also brought familiar sorrows and joys. The shocking deaths in early November of two novices in London from typhus, contracted after visiting a family in which seven children had fever. There was also the gradual worsening of her nephew James's consumptive condition, the pleasure of a short visit to Carlo in late November, relief at Mary Aloysius Scott's recovery of health, because Catherine was planning on her to be the superior in Birr, and amusement at Daniel O'Connell's complimentary but overly dramatic speech about the ministry of the Sisters of Mercy. Catherine writes about this twice. She evidently had the newspaper clipping. Daniel O'Connell was arguing, of course, that Ireland should not be oppressed, and he gave as one of the great reasons why it should not be oppressed, that you could look in the poorest section of any rural village or in the city, and you would see this black figure moving across the horizon toward the hovel where some poor man or woman was dying. And only when you got a glimpse of the educated foot did you know that this was the Sister of Mercy. And there was great cheering. Catherine said she kept the clipping in her desk to read it from time to time in order to increase her humility. And she also said that there was a great debate going on at recreation about exactly whose educated foot O'Connell had seen. Although Catherine fussed a bit during this period about the durability and appearance of the fabric used for veils and cloaks in Carlow and Wexford, and about the recruiting methods of the convent in Nace, lay people from Nace having come to Begut Street to try to talk a young postulant in the Begut Street community into leaving Begut Street and entering Nace. The extant letters of these months reveal the larger worries on her mind. The pension school, now opened in Kingston as a means of securing funding for the poor school, was severely under-enrolled. And at least six sisters had to be professed, received, or admitted prior to her departure for Burr on December 26. The residue of fatigue from her earlier travels led her to admit just twice that she was worn out. But a striking feature of this period is Catherine's fidelity to her duty, as she perceived it, of letter writing to the foreign powers. Her playful term for the superiors and other sisters in the foundations outside of Dublin. The 22 extant letters from her in November, December 1840 represent only a fraction of the letters she actually wrote. Yet of these, 13 were written to sisters in Carlow, Galway, Limerick, London, Naas, and Wexford. Although she was in no sense the superior of any of these sisters, except the two loaned to London, she evidently felt a deep obligation to befriend and encourage them. By her affection, her good humor, and her sharing of news when visits were not possible. Their ever affectionate M.C. Macaulay, as she signed herself, was a disciplined correspondent, doing what she could to support the grace of God within them, writing not just to the superiors of these convents, but to novices and postulants and young professed sisters. She who was almost universally over twice their age. One paragraph in the letter to Mary DeSales White on December 20th summarizes the purity of heart that gave Catherine Macaulay strength in her travels and her labors, and that would, she prayed, give strength to her sisters. It will be a paragraph familiar to you. We have one solid comfort amidst all this tripping about. Our hearts can always be in the same place, centered in God, for whom alone we go forward or stay back. Often when that sentence is quoted, we stop after centered in God. Our hearts can always be in the same place, centered in God. For whom alone we go forward or stay back is an important other half of Catherine's thought. O may he look on us with love and pity, she writes, and then we shall be able to do anything he wishes us to do, no matter how difficult to accomplish or painful to our feelings. If he looks on us with approbation for one instant each day, it will be sufficient to bring us joyfully on to the end of our journey. On January 20th, 1841, Catherine wrote to Bagot Street. With all around me covered in snow and my poor fingers petrified, I will endeavor to write a few lines to you. She was in Burr, the new foundation of Sisters of Mercy in the central tableland of Ireland, where she spent the first 6 weeks of 1841. In Burr, which she called her poor Bethlehem, Catherine trudged through the snow and cold, visiting families bitterly wounded by the long-standing schism in the local church. Yet, despite the seriousness of their mission of reconciliation, she was amazingly refreshed in Burr by the newborn energy of Mary Aloysius Scott, of whom Catherine said, "We keep our lights under a bushel." By the pure, sparkling spring water she found there, and by the humorous comments their presence in the town elicited. As she wrote in early January, "Hurrah for foundations, makes the old young and the young merry." True, Dr. Patrick Kennedy, the Bishop of Killaloe, was, as she said, no great patron of nuns. The parish priest was too busy to help them, and Reverend Theobald Matthew, who had begged them to go to Birr, disappointed them by not responding to mail and not coming, as he had promised, to the first reception ceremony there on February 2nd. But still, there were causes for laughter. Catherine's own mourning cloak turned into a makeshift petticoat, her whole wardrobe soaked with mud and melted snow. The tiny teacups in Birr, baby toys, she said, compared to a real bag at street drink of tea. She liked a good size cup. And the sweet little mice. Even the mice were sweet to Catherine. When Catherine returned alone to Dublin on February 10th, after a coach journey of 10 hours, new concerns commanded her attention. Mary DePazzi Delaney had been ill with one of her recurring bouts of epilepsy, and Cecilia Marmion, the mistress of novices, was worn out training 15 novices and postulants and entertaining 5 bishops who had been in Dublin for the solemn consecration of the new St. Andrew's Church and for their annual synod. Moreover, typhus had struck Wexford and Limerick communities. London influenza hit 6 at Bagot Street, and a great change had overcome Catherine's nephew, James, now dying in Kingston. The 19 extant letters of early 1841, all of them written to Sisters of Mercy, conclude in the first week of Lent, the last Lenten season of Catherine's life. In a profoundly reflective letter to Mary de Sales White in London, Catherine recommends true mortification and cautions against excessive fasting. You will be far more mortified, she says, in taking that which you do not like to take than in abstaining from it. She then remarks with her proverbial common sense, let us take one day only in hands at a time, merely making a resolve for tomorrow. Thus, we may hope to get on, taking short, careful steps, not great strides. In Catherine's letters in March and April 1841, one notices her persistent cough, the impending heartache of her nephew James's death, the ever-increasing obligations of corresponding with sisters in the foundations outside of Dublin, her concern about the future of Mary Clare Moore, a temporary superior in Bermondsey, who, at the request of the Bishop of Cork, will be leaving London to return to Cork, her concern about Redmond O'Hanlon, who was recovering from influenza, and about the health of Cecilia Marmion, now in Birr. Here, one also sees the characteristic details that endear the human portrait of Catherine Macaulay. Her unavailing efforts to doctor herself, her barely suppressed annoyance at the pokiness of Clare Augustine Moore's artwork. She remarked in one letter, you cannot believe how little she does in one day. Catherine had very little grasp of the time and care involved in calligraphy and manuscript illumination. And when Clare Augustine Moore showed her 3 leaves that she had painted in one day, Catherine wrote, 3 leaves, 3 rose and lily, or lily leaves. And she's flabbergasted. In this period, we also see her occasional weariness, her efforts to be a serious-minded mistress of novices in Cecilia Marmion's absence, yet her playfulness with the postulants and novices, her delight in the St. Patrick's Day parade of teetotalers in Dublin, described with such detail she would have had to have been standing on a street corner watching it, or else read a very detailed newspaper article. Her need to work around the moods and preferences of her nonetheless beloved De Pazzi Delaney, and always her gratitude that despite all, the blessing of unity still dwells amongst us, and oh, what a blessing. It should make all things else pass into nothing. Ever since her trip to Galway in mid-1840, Catherine had suffered from what she called an old man's cough, a harbinger, as she may have realized, of the consumption that would claim her life. Yet May and June were extremely busy months for her. First, of course, there was the sad burial on May 1st of her eldest nephew, James, the last, as she thought, of her sister's children, so that she had, as she said, nothing now to draw me for 1 hour from my religious sisters. On May 4th, three novices professed their vows, including Catherine's cousin and godchild, Teresa Byrne, and four postulants received the habit at Bagot Street. Catherine was in Birr from May 7th to May 23rd, helping to prepare the two Birr postulants for their reception of the habit on May 20th. And plans were emerging for a future foundation in Liverpool. Only later, in the last 6 weeks of her life, would there be any alteration of Catherine's ministry. For now, there was Francis Gibson, a postulant from Liverpool, to be welcomed, new veiling to be sent to Carlo, the journey home from Birr with a cross driver, slow horses, and broken harness to be accepted, our old beloved companion, the returning Mary Clare Moore, now very thin, to be embraced, the obstinate cough of Justina Fleming, a novice, to be worried over, and Bishop John England to be teased when he came looking for sisters for Charleston, South Carolina. He was making a journey around Ireland, trying to recruit sisters for the Americas, and Catherine was already overcommitted at Bagot Street, but he came to Bagot Street. So she went to the youngest and the smallest and the most recent postulant, Margaret Teresa Dwyer. And she said, now when he asks for volunteers for America, you stand up and volunteer, volunteer to be the superior. And she did. And as Catherine said, he could see that we were a community waiting to come to maturity. And then she said, you know, she didn't think the postulant would have her in it, have it in her to go along with this joke, but she was very pleased she did. May and June 1841 were also months of poetry, grateful remembrances, concern over creepy crawly Nace, encouragement of her last born child, poor Burr, and the kind of deep personal prayer that Catherine Macaulay never discussed in her letters. In the summer months of 1841, Catherine's correspondence was heavy. Dr. Thomas Ewens was encouraged to seek the new foundation for Liverpool from Carlo. Bishop Thomas Walsh, and in his absence, Archbishop Murray, was pressed to set a date for the August ceremony. Mary Aloysius Scott in Burr was assured that affiliation with the national system of education was beneficial. Mary Ann Doyle was supported in her interpretation of poverty. Frances Ward was consoled when Carlo was not chosen for the foundation in Liverpool. And Teresa White was congratulated on the wonderful progress in Galway. Closer to home, Catherine herself, Father Macaulay, as she quipped, conducted the annual retreat at Poor Bagot Street. 10 novices and postulants received daily instruction from her prior to their profession and reception ceremony on August 19th, and the journey to Birmingham began on August 20th. Catherine's cough was now more troublesome, especially at night, now aggravated somewhat by speaking and always by fresh air, now on the minds of her companions near and far. Only at the end of August, when she declined an invitation from Bishop George Brown to come to Galway, did Catherine herself, still in Birmingham, plainly describe the situation. She wrote, "If I remain any time in a room with a window open, I am coughing all night and disturbing the poor sisters who are near me. To travel in October would be very imprudent indeed." But during these months, her emotional energy was characteristically strong. Hoping, finally, to get official word that Gregory XVI had confirmed the rule and constitutions. Feeling relief that, as she erroneously thought, the Bermondsey community under Claire Agnew was now going on remarkably well. Grieving the serious illness of Justina Fleming and dreading, ironically as it turned out, the severe trial Justina's death would be to those at Bagot Street. Sending kisses to little Fanny Ward in Carlow, Frances Ward's niece, comforting the novice Frances Gibson in the death of her sister, and taking her as traveling companion to England so she could console her parents. When Frances Ward invited Catherine to come to Carlow for the annual retreat in August 1841, Catherine was deeply grateful, even tempted, but she declined. She said, "It would be delightful to me to accept, but think of all that must be left behind. It is quite impossible for anyone in my situation to think of pleasing themselves. My pleasure must be in endeavoring to please all." Catherine spent July and August trying to do just that. When she arrived in Birmingham, she frankly did not admire Pugin's gilded figures of saints in the chapel of the Birmingham convent. "By no means calculated to inspire devotion," she said. But her heart, if not her full voice, was wholly in the Te Deum sung there in the late afternoon on August 21st, 1841, at the inauguration of what was to be her last new foundation of Sisters of Mercy. "Let thy mercy, O Lord, be upon us, as we have put our trust in thee. In thee, O Lord, have I put my trust. Let me not be confounded forever." The final months of Catherine's life were, until 2 or 3 weeks before the end, not unlike the previous 10 years. She traveled home from Birmingham on September 20th, 21st. She grieved the death in Burr of a young priest devoted to the poor. She wrote affectionate letters to several sisters. She reviewed with help, her copy of the approved rule and constitutions of the Sisters of Mercy, printed in Italian. And she met with a priest from Rome about some evident mistakes. She admitted that she had had a surfeit of traveling. She arranged for the dying Justina Fleming to receive care in Tullamore, where the air was better for her. She responded to the claim of a building supplier that she owed £130 for timber and slates for the Booterstown convent. She secured, with her last two extant letters, a £20 legacy bequeathed to the community. And in one letter, on September 26th, she acknowledged that she had twice seen Dr. William Stokes, a very distinguished physician specializing in ailments of the chest, who said her right lung was diseased. Only in the last 2 weeks of her life, when she was 63, bedridden and dying, was there any transformation of her zealous activity. Then the humility that had long characterized her self-perception took the form of relinquishing to others, with encouraging confidence in their abilities, some of her personal responsibilities as superior, and then doing what she could in the days that remained to reassure and encourage the Bagot Street community. She had seen in the new postulants and novices at Bagot Street and in the foundations beyond Dublin some of the fire Christ cast kindling. In the end, her own Christ fire burned with exquisite compassion, even to her requesting that the sisters gathered about her in her last hours, get a good cup of tea when I am gone and comfort one another. Cathy McCauley died at about 10 minutes before 8 in the evening of November 11th, 1841. Her body, now totally spent in the work of mercy, was buried in the Garden Cemetery of Bagot Street on Monday morning, November 15th, 1841. about the union of prayer and the works of mercy. She is saying that the works of mercy are a spiritual act of union with God, and that prayer is the animation of the works of mercy. Later in the essay, after defining the duties of Sisters of Mercy as the works of mercy, she says even more emphatically, "We ought therefore to make account that our perfection consists in acquitting ourselves well of these duties, so that though the spirit of prayer and retreat should be most dear to us, yet such a spirit as would never withdraw us from these works of mercy. Otherwise, it should be regarded as a temptation rather than the effect of sincere piety." She goes on, "It would be an artifice of the enemy, who, transforming himself into an angel of light, would endeavor to withdraw us from our vocation under the pretense of laboring for our advancement. We ought to give ourselves to prayer in the true spirit of our vocation to obtain new vigor, zeal, and fervor in the exercise of our state." Catherine then claims something truly astounding about the prayer of Sisters of Mercy, about its particular character and source. She says, "God never calls any person to any state or for any end without giving the means and necessary helps to carry them through all the difficulties of it. And this being sufficiently established, it is not to be doubted but that when God institutes a religious order, he gives at the same time the grace that is necessary for such an order and for all those who are called to that order, that all may attain to the perfection for which it was designed. The fruit which God intended when he instituted the order and granted the means to propagate it." And she goes on, "It follows that each society of religious receives a grace particularly adapted to the duties which they are called to perform. We ought then have great confidence in God in the discharge of all these offices of mercy, spiritual and corporal, which constitute the business of our lives, and assure ourselves that God will particularly concur with us to render them efficacious, as by his infinite mercy we daily experience, and this proceeds from the grace belonging to the vocation or grace of the order." What Catherine is claiming here, and with very great confidence, is that the prayer proper to Sisters of Mercy is prayer shaped by the works of mercy, and that this kind of prayer is not something arising from or designed by our own efforts, but is rather already a gift of God to us, a grace already given to us in view of the duties of our particular state. Our prayer is, to quote her, "a grace particularly adapted to the duties which we are asked to perform." In other words, accompanying our call to the business of our particular lives is the gift of the kind of prayer that is peculiarly and intimately related and supportive of that business, the works of mercy. Each of us may have an intuitive sense of that already given gift of prayer, but each of us may also need to spend time letting the reality of that gift sink as deeply as possible into our hearts. What Catherine is saying is that the Spirit of God already groans and prays in our hearts in the manner necessary to the fulfillment of the works of mercy. That whatever vigor, zeal, and fervor, to use her words, is needed in our works of mercy, is the fruit of the prayer God is already praying within us. And that, in some very real sense, the prayer of Sisters of Mercy and their colleagues in mercy will be different from the prayer of those who do not have our particular God-given vocation. In one of the most moving letters Catherine wrote in 1840, she tells Catherine Maher in Nace about two young women whom she has had to turn away from the House of Mercy because the house is crowded to excess with about 60 women and girls who have lost employment. She says, "We have every day most sorrowful applications from interesting young creatures, confectioners and dressmakers, who at this season cannot get employment and are quite unprotected. I am sure I spoke with two yesterday who were hungry, though of nice appearance. Their dejected faces have been before me ever since. I was afraid of hurting their feelings by offering them food and had no money." In Catherine's understanding, the true prayer of Sisters of Mercy and their partners in the works of mercy will be prayer in communion with dejected faces. It will be prayer shaped in a fundamental way by a deep vein of God-given sorrow and empathy for those who suffer. Catherine's own prayer arose from the memory of dejected faces, including the face of Jesus Christ in his passion and death. In the Bermondsey Annals, Claire Moore tells us that Catherine meditated with heartfelt attention the great mysteries of faith, and feeling as she did so sensibly for the sufferings of her fellow creatures, her compassion for those endured by our blessed Lord was extreme. So much so, says Claire Moore, that it was a real pain to her, as she once told a sister in confidence, to meditate on that subject. She had, for many years of her life, fasted on Good Friday without taking any refreshment whatever, until she became a religious, and then she conformed to the custom which she established for the community of taking a little bread and gruel standing. In the copy of the rule and constitutions that she sent to Rome in early 1840, Catherine included, with some slight revision, the paragraph on devotion to the Passion of Jesus Christ in the presentation rule. Her paragraph reads, "The sisters shall have the most affectionate devotion to the Passion of Jesus Christ. They shall often recall to mind and meditate on the different circumstances of it in order to excite in themselves an ardent desire of conforming their hearts to their suffering Redeemer, persuaded that to share hereafter in his glory, they must here participate in his great humiliation." In a later chapter of the rule, Catherine urges the mistress of novices to remind those who are discerning the implications of religious profession that this institute is, in a special manner, founded on Calvary, there to serve a crucified Redeemer. The danger of the Christian life and of contemplation of the passion and death of Jesus is that we stop there. Horrified and grief-stricken over a past crucifixion and grateful for it in an uncostly way. Catherine had great devotion to the passion of Jesus Christ, that moment within the larger moment of the Paschal mystery, but she also had great sensitivity to the continuing presence of the cross of Christ in human life. What does all this mean for us? It means that the founding faith of our community was profoundly Christocentric and incarnational. It means that the core of our original charism as a community was a consciousness of our redeemed condition, of our being the fruit of Christ's death. It means that we have available to us, in the original inspiration of our founder, a special sensitivity to suffering, bodily, mental, emotional, spiritual, all the kinds of embodied suffering Jesus and our contemporaries experience. It means that when we feel the sufferings of God's people, this feeling is the very gift of God, our special charism. It means that on the basis of our heritage as Sisters of Mercy, we are called to a very down-to-earth, fleshly, tangible ministry of comforting and consoling, and that we are asked to see ourselves as called to be the comforters and consolers of our world. It means that we are called to a very great tenderness toward the sufferings of other people, that we are called to be a presence of tenderness in this world. Catherine's tenderness toward the sufferings of human beings led her to tenderness toward Jesus' sufferings, and her tenderness toward the passion of Jesus led her to even greater tenderness toward those who suffer the passion of Christ today. So we are not called to some kind of stereotypically masculine toughness, but to sympathy, tears, and tenderness. Catherine knew that some aspects of the crosses of Christ that we meet in our personal and historical realities should be healed or reformed or denounced by us. But she also knew that some aspects of the crosses of Christ we meet are beyond our present capacity to heal or to reform or to denounce. These are grounded in the mystery of humanity and in the mystery of God. It is these crosses that we can only patiently receive with gratitude and trust and hope. I would like to conclude by reflecting all too briefly on Catherine's emphasis on charity. The chapter on the presentation rule on union and charity, and you will have a copy of that tomorrow, was the only rule of the Sisters of Mercy for the first 6 years of the congregation. When Catherine came home from George's Hill and Archbishop Murray came to Bagot Street to recognize and install her as the superior of the newly founded Sisters of Mercy, she said to him, "What shall we use for a rule until we have prepared our own?" And he took a copy of the presentation rule, opened it to the chapter on union and charity, and said, "If they observe this, it will be enough." This chapter that Catherine incorporated almost verbatim into the mercy rule she sent to Rome, except for one paragraph on the titles of the sisters, which she deleted. This chapter is the theological explanation of Catherine's own practice of charity, and her own practice of charity is the explanation of this chapter. Here Catherine says that loving one another constitutes the love of God, that loving one's neighbor, not just one's neighbor down the street, but one's neighbor in the community, and loving God are inseparably united, and that Christ desires our mutual love to be so lavish as to resemble the love and union between Christ and his Father. She writes, "This mutual union and love should eminently characterize religious souls. This should distinguish them above all others as faithful servants of Jesus Christ. The sisters of this institute, founded and grounded on charity, should therefore make this favorite virtue of their divine master their own most favorite virtue. This they should study to maintain and cherish so perfectly amongst them as to live together as if they had but one heart and one soul in God. They shall, as true followers of God, walk in love as Christ loved us, preserving above all things charity, and in sincerity of heart, fervently loving each other." When the rule went to Rome, for some reason, that sentence got deleted. They shall, as true followers of God, walk in love as Christ loved us, preserving above all things charity, and in sincerity of heart, fervently loving each other. I don't know whether it was the fervently loving each other that got them nervous. This chapter of union and charity is one that we need to read very often. It presents a great central purpose of our religious community in a most demanding and thoroughly gospel way. We are to be a community of such mutual love as to resemble and give witness to the community of love that God is. If we do not have union and charity, and it is easy to fall away from charity, no strategic plan, no chapter, no assembly, no weekend with an imported speaker, no retirement fund, no ministry, no administrative structure will be a substitute for it. Catherine McCauley herself said as much. In the Practical Sayings, Claire Moore records Catherine's words. She says, Catherine said, "The prosperity or advancement of the Institute does not depend on, nor is it to be attributed to, the good reader, writer, or highly accomplished religious, but to the humble, cordial, affectionate, obliging, complying, and charitable sister. Our exercises of charity performed abroad will have no value before God if there be not established at home a solid foundation of this virtue. And although want of health or capacity may hinder a sister from taking part in the active duties or zealous works of the Institute, she is yet doing a great deal both for God and her community if she is kind and charitable to all. Our Divine Savior's example should be before us under all circumstances, particularly in exercising charity toward our neighbor, and more especially toward those who are united with us in religion. Claire Moore tells us that when in 1868 she sent a copy of these practical sayings to all the First Sisters of Mercy, Ursula Frayne, then in Melbourne, responded, "How exactly, dear Reverend Mother's words are noted down. I could almost fancy myself listening to her once more." And that was 27 years after Catherine's death. In the Limerick manuscript, Mary Vincent Harnett says that Catherine's exhortations were most animating and impressive, especially on the virtues of humility and charity. She writes, "These were her characteristic virtues, and on St. Paul's description of charity, she loved to expatiate, most earnestly striving to reduce it to practice herself and to induce all to do the same. She loved all and sought to do good to all. She taught the sisters to avoid all that might be in the least contrary to charity, even the slightest remark, so that they should make it a rule never to say anything unfavorable of each other. She was not content with their avoiding the smallest faults against this favorite virtue of our blessed Lord. She wished their whole conduct should evince that this virtue reigned in their hearts." We make a great mistake, of course. We do a great injustice to Catherine's humanity if we think she had no faults, if we think she did not regret and grieve her weaknesses. Her failures were not the great neglects I am conscious of in myself, but they were her kind of weakness, the kind she dreaded most, failures of charity, especially impatience, her tendency to measure others by her own energy and passion. The Bermondsey Annals recalls a particularly poignant scene in this regard, involving, I believe, Mary Claire Augustine Moore, the artist, about whom Catherine once wrote, as I have said, "Indeed, you can have no idea how little she does in a week." Claire Moore, to whom her sister Claire Augustine must have told this story, writes of Catherine, "One act of self-abasement which occurred within the last 4 years of her life ought not to be passed over in silence. It was related with tears by the sister who was the subject of it to a friend. She had spoken, as she thought, rather sharply to her. And a few hours after, she went to the sister," that is, Catherine went to the sister, "and asked her, did she remember who was present at the time? As several had been there, the sister answered she could hardly say, for she had not noticed which they were. But as our Reverend Mother requested her to try and call them to mind and bring them to her, they were summoned. And when all assembled, our dear Reverend Mother humbly knelt down and begged her forgiveness for the manner in which she had spoken to her that morning." I think, when was the last time I knelt to ask the forgiveness of another sister of mercy, as there would have been many occasions to do. Sometimes at recreation, Catherine liked to explore the meaning of words. One such word was cordial. Now, we might hear a certain stiffness in that word, but Clara Moore says Catherine found warmth and life in the word. Clara writes, "She loved to expatiate on certain words. She would say, 'Our mutual respect and charity is to be cordial.' Now, cordial signifies something that revives, invigorates, and warms. Such should be the effects of our love for each other." Wouldn't it be something if we saw ourselves as called each day to so love others, including our own sisters, that we revived, invigorated, and warmed them? It may very well be that our central and most crucial ministry is to be communities of sincere mutual love, to be places in this world where the joy and beauty of genuine mutual love is made real for people to see and share, to be places in this world where patience, forgiveness, understanding, and large-heartedness support true union and charity. Places where people can get a human inkling of what the infinitely greater love of God is like. If we could surrender to the fullness of this mutual love, we would fulfill the last wish of Catherine Macaulay, as Elizabeth Moore recorded it 10 days after Catherine's death. Elizabeth writes, "Of our beloved Reverend Mother, what shall I or what can I say but that she died the death of the just? Cautious as she was from bringing herself into notice unnecessarily in health, she was still more so in sickness, waiting on herself even in her last agony, preserving to the last moment the same peace and serenity of mind which so eminently characterized her through life, omitting not an iota of what was essential and totally disregarding all but what was of moment. I was not at all aware that her death was so near. I was full of hope till Wednesday morning about 11 o'clock. That is, the day before her death. Had I then known what I since heard, I would not have been so unprepared for the shock. She was herself well aware she was dying for the last 6 months, and since her return from Birmingham, cautiously avoided anything like business. It is only by her acts we can judge of her mind. On Thursday morning, about 2 o'clock, she called for a piece of paper and twine, tied up her boots, and desired them to be put in the fire. About 4 in the morning, she desired the bed to be moved to the center of the room, that she would soon want air. About 7, she desired the sisters to be brought to her, said to each one individually what was most suited, but her first and last injunction to all was to preserve union and peace amongst each other, that if they did, they would enjoy great happiness, such as they would wonder where it came from. About 5 in the evening, She asked for the candle to be placed in her hand. We commence the last prayers. When we thought the senses must be going and that it might be well to rouse attention by praying a little louder, she said, "No occasion, my darling, to speak so loud. I hear distinctly." In this way, she continued till 10 minutes before 8, when she calmly breathed her last sigh. I did not think it possible for human nature to have such self-possession at the awful moment of death, but she had an extraordinary mind in life and death. An extraordinary mind, yes, but a religious congregation that is founded by a woman who, in the end, asks her sisters only to preserve union and peace amongst each other, and who, with her last breath, calls her sisters, "My darling," must also have an extraordinary heart. So, buried questions, buried thoughts. Yes, thanks, Agnes Vanna White.
Mary, I'd be grateful if you could comment on the friendship. I'd be grateful if you could comment on the friendships between the first seven, particularly that of Catherine McCauley with Elizabeth Moore and also with Claire Moore and Frances Ward and Marianne Doyle. I'm mindful that it was Elizabeth Moore who was there.
I missed the very last thing you were saying.
I'm mindful that it was Elizabeth Moore who was actually at Baggot Street when Catherine died, and not any of the others. There are obviously glimpses in the correspondence of their friendships, but I'd be grateful if you could comment further.
The question is about the friendships among the first seven, with and including Catherine McCauley. And then the comment was made, was it only Elizabeth Moore who was there when Catherine died, as well as De Passy Delaney? Always keep in mind as we approach this question that it's very much related to who saved letters. Catherine McCauley did not save any letter from any Sister of Mercy except one poem from Ursula Frayne to which she responded. So I don't think that was kind of a deliberate act on her part. It got sent back to Ursula Frayne, and that preserved it. And the same was true of the four-line poem from the Novices about, "Please give us cash to buy cake ingredients." She wrote on the same piece of paper and sent it back to them. She did preserve some letters, but they were just a handful of business letters that were kept at Baggot Street, plus letters she received from bishops that got forwarded to Rome. And there are two letters I have found from Andrew Fitzgerald, one that she forwarded to the Archbishop to read because it was in support of her position on the chaplaincy controversy, and one that she must have shown Frances Ward because it was the letter in which Fitzgerald wrote to her and said, "Come to Carlo, you know, come here and rest." So she did not save any letters from any of these people. Her letters to Claire Moore have not been preserved. So, we have no kind of correspondence between the two of them.
There are 19 letters to Elizabeth Moore that are preserved, but none after Easter 1841. Now, surely there were letters after that. I have this little unofficial theory about letters that the more dear a letter was to you, and you got it in the last year of the person's life, the more you would be inclined to have it some special place where it would also get lost or get frayed or get so folded that it would fall apart. Because, I mean, that seems to be the case. One of the most damaged letters is the letter Catherine wrote in September 1841 to Teresa Carton at Bagot Street when she asks her to please get a bed cut down for me, put it in the corner of the infirmary. You can sleep in the other corner. You know, I won't be disturbed by you. And for Frances Ward, we have, she preserved about 75 letters. She took them all with her to the United States, and that's why they are distributed in various regional communities throughout the United States with a big group of them in our Institute archives in Silver Spring. All we know about those last 2 months of Catherine's life, in terms of any eyewitness account, is the biographical manuscripts written about her by people who knew her and her letters. We shouldn't conclude that if one of her surviving letters doesn't say that Frances Ward came to Bagot Street, she didn't come to Bagot Street. She could have, you know. Or the same would be true of Mary Ann Doyle. I mean, I always have to keep reminding myself of what I don't have in the way of evidence and not use what we do have in the way of evidence to go beyond it. There's a scrap of a letter to Frances Ward that gets reported in Austin Carroll's biography. And Austin Carroll evidently had transcripts made by Josephine Ward of letters that Josephine had access to. She was Frances Ward's sister, and there's a line, we shall meet again, but not at present. Whether that's an authentic line in an authentic letter or not, I can't say. I mean, one could hypothesize that Frances Ward came, but that it's not recorded. Why would Catherine record that in a letter to Aloysius Scott and Burr? You know, or to somebody else, and that they had some understanding, you know, that maybe she came before the last week. What Elizabeth Moore says is that she was sent for. She says she was sent for. And I think she might have been sent for by De Pazzi Delaney. And if you read the letters of Mary Vincent Whitty, which describe the last week of Catherine's life, she says